Case number 22-3025, United States of America versus Edward Magruder, appellant. Mr. Searby for the appellant, Mr. McGovern for the appellee.
Mr. Searby, good morning.
Good morning, Judge Henderson. May it please the court. Bruce Searby appearing for appellant Edward Magruder. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time. And as far as a roadmap, I'd like to accomplish three things with my opening. First, I'd like to emphasize Mr. Magruder's argument relating to the liberal standard for withdrawal of his guilty plea under Rule 11D based on the warrantless search of his backpack where heroin was found, which argument his attorney missed, and to this day, the government has offered no evidence establishing a justification for this warrantless search. Second, I would like to turn to the Louisiana warrant that we've raised. I'd like to disclose, under my duty of candor to the court, new information that the government has brought to my attention just in the past few days that could be seen to undercut appellant's argument about the Louisiana warrant. And third, I'd like to argue to you, notwithstanding this new information, that Mr. Magruder deserves to withdraw his guilty plea based on a defective Louisiana warrant and his counsel's failure to raise that below, or at least get a remand to develop the record. So starting on the first point, the backpack. The government has never offered evidence justifying the warrantless search of Mr. Magruder's backpack. And his counsel, who advised his guilty plea, was constitutionally deficient in failing to pursue a motion. And the district court abused discretion in denying his chance to withdraw his guilty plea and to pursue and explore suppression of the backpack search. There were, in this case, no facts showing that agents were already in the process of arresting appellant for a drug conspiracy when they searched his backpack. It would be unprecedented, and this would let loose, frankly, laziness and utter disrespect for the warrant requirement if this case went the government's way.
When you say that there's no facts showing that the agents already knew something at the specific time of searching the backpack, are you suggesting that they needed to have told Mr. Magruder right then and there, or what are you getting at with respect to when someone should have known about that?
I'm sorry, Judge Childs. What I was trying to say is that the agents were not already in the process of arresting Mr. Magruder when they did the backpack search. It's not what they knew. That's not the issue that I'm pointing to right now. It's what they were doing. Agents were not already in the process of arresting Mr. Magruder. Therefore, you cannot bring in the search incident to arrest doctrine, which is exactly what the district court agreed with the government about that justified the warrantless search.
And what about the months-long ongoing investigation that was occurring in Louisiana that brought us forward to that date, as well as the various warrants in that regard?
That did not create probable cause for the arrest on a drug distribution and possession with intent to distribute charge, which is exactly the only reason that agents arrested Mr. Magruder after searching his backpack. That all had to, what you just mentioned, all had to do with a drug conspiracy in several months prior. Now, what agents really did is they wanted to search Mr. Magruder's backpack. They were not in the process of already arresting him for a drug conspiracy, which is what the government now seeks to do to bring in the search incident to arrest the doctrine.
So you're saying that despite that they had all this information, meaning the Louisiana contingency of police officers, investigators, et cetera, knew that Mr. Magruder was making these trips from DC to New York, and that on that particular day, this trip was consistent with the information that they had previously had, that you're saying that these agents did not have any of that information available to them, despite that this particular trip was similar to other trips that he had made that they were aware of?
No, Judge Childs, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that they did not have probable cause to arrest the defendant for a drug distribution charge or drug possession with intent to distribute, which is what they actually arrested him for. They also do not get to use the search incident to arrest doctrine, which is an exception to the warrant requirement, based upon this drug conspiracy evidence that they had accumulated.
Even if they start out with whatever is part of the months-long investigation and they have an ability to arrest based on the fruits of that particular investigation for a specific charge, but then they come upon him and there's something else they see, are you telling me that they can't arrest for something different?
Yes, Your Honor. There was no probable cause at that point for them to arrest based upon possession with intent to distribute, and cases cited by the government for the proposition that they can still use the search incident for arrest doctrine are distinguishable. They're distinguishable because of what I started saying, which is that agents were not already in the process of arresting the defendant for a drug conspiracy when they searched his backpack. Therefore, that line is
and
irrelevant.
And I move off of this, but I'm still trying to get, where are you getting that agents were not in the process of arresting him when they are there, apparently based on information that they've had in Louisiana that is consistent on that day with all of the same information from before? So where are you getting that they were not there that day to do the same thing, that something's compatible with what was going on in Louisiana?
Well, my point is that there was absolutely no evidence in the record ever to this day that they were there to arrest him on a drug conspiracy charge supported by the evidence that you're referring to. They were not doing that. At least there's no evidence in the record that they were doing that. Rather, the only evidence in the record is the complaint affidavit of one of the arresting agents who said that he gets off the bus, they search his backpack, and then they arrest him. So there's absolutely nothing entered into the record by the government supporting this idea that they were actually there to arrest him on a drug conspiracy charge.
Could they have arrested him?
What's that?
Could they have arrested him on a drug conspiracy? Did they have probable cause for that?
They did have probable cause for months old drug conspiracy.
I'm not
conduct.
As an agent. I'm asking you just an answer to the question. Direct question.
Yes, they could have arrested.
They could have arrested. So there's no question that they could have arrested him right then and there.
They could have, but they weren't going to until they found the drugs pursuant to the search.
Well, that's a lot of subjective intent that we don't normally get into in probable cause inquiries. So if probable cause existed, as Judge Childs has been discussing with you, to arrest him, then there was cause to do a search incident to arrest. And we have case laws, do many other courts, saying that the before after doesn't matter as long as they are very proximate in time. And if you agreed that he had probable cause, what is your best case that the probable cause has to be for the specific crime for which he is subsequently then charged?
Your Honor, because in the brief that we filed, in the reply in the opening brief, we distinguish all those cases that you're referring to. And the Rawlings case is distinguishable. There, the defendant had already confessed to a crime by the time the search was made, that the police, based on that confession.
You've agreed that they had probable cause to arrest and therefore search at the time they approached him and took his backpack. They already had all of that. So I appreciate the careful distinctions in your brief from these other cases. I'm just asking, what's your best case that since they had probable cause to arrest and therefore search, it is somehow dissipates or is no longer sufficient because of their subjective intent to arrest for a different?
Because, Your Honor, that makes a difference. The intent of the officer makes a difference in all these cases. They're in this line of cases that the government now wants to rely on. And so if you read Rawlings, if you read Powell, if you read the other cases that we carefully go through, it does matter what evidence there is in the record of what the officers had been doing before they, and what they had been going to arrest the person for. So it's absolutely essential, and the distinction that I'm pointing out is critical. All the government had to do below.
We would have to adopt a subjective intent test for to write an opinion for you. We would have to say, for these purposes, you want to do a search or a search and then arrest, you want to reverse the order, then subjective intent is controlling.
Your Honor, I think actually you'd have to do the opposite, which is create a whole new layer of exception to the search warrant, to the doctrine that you need a search warrant. And if you don't, you can do it search incident to arrest. Now there's this line of cases about the exact timing of events. This case would push that and extend that way too far, Your Honor, by disregarding what the officers were intending to do before the search.
You keep saying intent, so there would have to be a subjective intent element to the test that you want us to adopt.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. And in these other cases, the record below in the district court had been fully developed so that you could have an exploration of what the officers were actually doing and what they were thinking and why they pulled someone over, why they searched somebody, why they had detained somebody. So this case is exceptional here because there's the only facts in the record go the other way. They go appellant Magruder's way, which is to say that the search appears to have been triggering the arrest and not some imminent arrest triggering the search. Mm-hmm. And that makes all the difference in the world because search incident to arrest exception is based upon things like danger to the police officers. They're about to make an arrest. And so even though they formally do it a little bit later, they still have the search incident to arrest doctrine available to protect themselves. So rather than us on the appellate side adding a new requirement, it's actually would be just loosening this doctrine that comes out of cases like Rawlings and Powell and Bookhart. These are all distinguishable for the reason that I've stated.
So you had information about the Louisiana warrant argument as well?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, the government informed me a few days ago that in fact, the first counsel for Mr. Magruder did receive the Louisiana warrant prior to the plea. Now, we would still say, of course, that there's an argument there for appellant. I just want to say that there is a big difference between Mr. Crawley, who is the court-appointed counsel who advised the guilty plea, receiving the 2018 Louisiana search warrant from the government on the one hand, and on the other, actually reading it and actually exploring the issues presented by that Louisiana warrant. So we think that it's not as I put it in the brief that Mr. Crawley never got the warrant from the government. But it's still the case that he evidently didn't do anything with it, maybe didn't even read it, and that new counsel came into the case not knowing, not having the warrant and needing to get it later. Now, just as to the point that the Louisiana warrant matters, I think that it hinges in terms of the court's jurisdiction to issue the warrant on this proposition that there was a connection between Mr. Magruder and the jurisdiction of Louisiana, and that ultimately there's somebody in Columbia who was the source of both Mr. Magruder's conversations and the drugs in Houston and Louisiana.
The affidavit talks about there's multiple people involved, and it seems to be focused on delivery of drugs into Louisiana.
Right.
And this other person shows up, Tony, with this phone number.
Right.
And probable cause is not, it's not a super high standard. It's a substantial standard, but it doesn't. You can have probable cause and it turns out not to be factually accurate at the end of the day, but we don't look at it in hindsight. Why wasn't there on the face of that affidavit probable cause to think that he was part of this group that was operating in New Orleans?
Because the agent who is in charge of presenting adequate probable cause, the only thing he had is the following phrase: it is believed that so-and-so in Columbia is the source. Mm-hmm. Now, Your Honors, if anyone came to you and argued it is to believe,
I'm not going to read
believed,
that one paragraph in isolation. You're going to read the whole affidavit. It's about multiple individuals. So it's clearly a multi-individual operation that definitely has a nexus to Louisiana. And the affidavit reads as though, and yet here's another person that's talking to the same guy. And so why isn't there at least probable cause there to think that he was part of this Louisiana operation, given the surrounding context in which they hear Tony talking, they identify the phone number, they hear the same types of conversations about drug dealing, that to say this, he must be part of this too.
Well, because there's actually no link between Tony and Louisiana, except through this one individual.
But that person is involved in dealing drugs in New Orleans. So again, it wouldn't be proof beyond a reasonable doubt by any means, maybe not even a preponderance. Or why wasn't it probable cause to think he was part of this grouping?
There wasn't probable cause of that. That's my point, which is that,
that's not probable cause, that he was, here's someone else who's talking to the same person who's dumping all this stuff in Louisiana.
Your Honor, there's not probable cause that the same individual talking to Tony was involved in Louisiana. There is the bare assertion that it is believed that passive voice, we don't know who, we don't know when, we don't know why. It is believed that's it, plus one, apparently maybe one phone call placed by Louisiana connection in Columbia. So there's nothing there. There's certainly no probable cause, even under a light standard, for making this connection. And they don't cite any evidence like you need when you go in and you're trying to establish a critical fact like this jurisdictional nexus. There's just nothing but it is believed that this man was the source. And the court cannot honor that as probable cause without opening the floodgates for the government to do very, very minimal work to establish its case in these search warrants, and without turning the government loose to just assert, well, it is believed that. In this case, that nexus, that's all it hangs on to. Plus, apparently, at some point in time, somebody called that same person and Tony called that same person. That's it. Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll give you a couple of minutes in reply. All right, Mr. McGovern.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Michael McGovern on behalf of the United States, appellee in this matter. After Mr. Magruder pled guilty pursuant to a plea agreement that his own counsel admitted gave him substantial concessions from the government, he engaged in protracted litigation to withdraw that plea agreement before the district court. Over many months, the district court considered each and every one of his claims, and in a series of four orders, written orders, rejected each and every one of those. Now Mr. Magruder is before you on appeal, advancing only two claims, one of which he never presented before the district court, and the other of which was presented but is entirely meritless. Because the first claim was never presented before the district court, and because the second claim is meritless, the district court did not abuse its discretion, which is the standard for evaluating the denial of the motion to withdraw, when it denied that motion to withdraw. Turning first to his new claim on appeal regarding the jurisdictional nexus of the 2008 warrant that was issued in the Eastern District of Louisiana. That claim was never presented to the district court. It's not properly before this court. There was no development of the record regarding what his counsel, the only way in which—
You often have ineffective assistance of counsel arguments raised in direct appeals for the first time on appeal for obvious reasons. It's a new attorney on the appeal, and we haven't treated those as forfeited in the past, have we?
No, Your Honor. So on a direct, and I'd like to point out that Your Honor correctly noted, those are majority of those decisions are in the context of a direct appeal. Here, we're talking about the direct appeal of a motion to withdraw. So
yeah, but it's still the direct appeal in his criminal case. That was denied. Final judgment was entered. This is a direct criminal appeal.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So I don't think how that's
I think I would distinguish this situation where there is an appropriate vehicle where he could raise a 2255 based on this claim and then be subject to appropriate procedural bars.
His argument is the two attorneys in district court did not raise this issue, and so were ineffective. There was no attorney in district court to raise their own self-ineffectiveness.
But,
which is why we allowed it to be raised here, and then we decide whether there's merit or potential merit or not. If there is, we can remand for fact-finding. If there's no legs to it, we can deny it. But I don't understand why this is a direct criminal appeal by a claim of ineffectiveness raised by a new attorney about the trial attorneys. And if your argument is we expected the trial attorneys to raise their own ineffectiveness, is that what you mean?
Well, here, given that there was new counsel for the motion to withdraw, yes, because
that person didn't identify this problem either. That person didn't identify the ineffectiveness of the prior attorney.
Which may be a ground for overcoming some type of procedural bar in a proper 2255 motion, but that would require the development of the record.
When an attorney does not ineffectively fail, let's just assume there's ineffectiveness. If an attorney ineffectively fails to argue ineffective assistance of counsel, we're going to say it's forfeited on direct appeal. When have we ever done that?
I have not seen a case in which they've done that. I also haven't seen that in the context of a motion to withdraw, which occurred after.
Withdraw would be different if his argument here is that neither attorney below raised this and should have. And even more so now, if in fact they actually had the Louisiana warrant, I just don't understand. I mean, we can proceed to other aspects of this argument,
absolutely.
But we've never.
And Your Honor,
forfeiture. We don't expect ineffectiveness to be raised by the attorneys who were alleged to be ineffective. I'm not saying anybody was or was not at this point, but that's the issue before us.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand your point. This court has said in the context of appeals of collateral attacks that where a ground for ineffectiveness hadn't been properly raised, it can't be then raised on appeal. I would analogize a motion to withdraw similarly, especially where they were represented by another counsel. But I take Your Honor's point, and turning to the other aspects, there's no need for a remand in this case because there is no merit to the allegation that there was no jurisdiction to issue the 2008 Louisiana warrant. That is because in Louisiana, agents were investigating a drug trafficking ring that was actively distributing drugs in Louisiana. There had been an indictment of certain of those individuals. Through wiretaps, they had identified the go-between who was in Colombia, who was providing the directions on how to pick up and how to pay for those drugs. And through a wiretap of that individual that was conducted by Colombian investigators, they tied that go-between to another member of a drug trafficking organization based in Colombia that was responsible or that was the supplier for the drugs in New Orleans. Through the wiretap in Colombia, they also picked up conversations Mr. Magruder was having with the higher individual in the drug trafficking organization in Colombia. And on those facts, those agents had probable cause. There was a reasonable inference to be drawn that the drug trafficking organization that had contacts with Louisiana was distributing drugs into the United States via Mr. Magruder. And because of that—
Into the United States or into Louisiana?
Was involved in a conspiracy to distribute drugs, which included overt acts distributing to Louisiana, which it had established
Where does the affidavit lay out probable cause to think that Mr. Magruder, in the affidavit, was distributing to Louisiana? What facts?
I don't believe that what the jurisdiction over the infants being investigated language would require is to show Tony's own overt acts in Louisiana. The requirement is that there be jurisdiction over the offense, and in a drug conspiracy, that offense can be charged, and there is jurisdiction to investigate it.
Right, so if this is helpful, you can clarify for me, was he being, I just don't see this in the affidavit for some of the reasons your friend has said on the other side has said, was he being investigated, or was the offense under investigation for purposes of Mr. Magruder, the delivery of drugs into Louisiana, or conspiracy to bring drugs into Louisiana, or was it, as you said, conspiracy to bring drugs somewhere into the United States?
The offense under investigation was the drug trafficking of the Colombian drug trafficking organization, which had known ties to Louisiana and which had known communications with Mr. Magruder.
So the defense under investigation was bringing drugs into Louisiana?
Yeah, yes.
I mean, if you have it, I'm trying to understand how you read the word jurisdiction in the Stored Communications Act. So it was the offense under investigation was a conspiracy and maybe actual acts of delivering drugs into from Colombia into Louisiana.
Correct.
And where is the connection in the affidavit to think that Tony, with a 202 area code, was part of that operation or a different operation, not yet being investigated, of bringing drugs into other places in the United States?
There was a connection between the supplier, a known supplier of drugs to New Orleans, was supplying another individual whose whereabouts were unknown, who had a 202 area code on a in the day of mobile phones. I don't know that that actually provides very much information for anyone as to location. And so at that point, so it's a reasonable inference that the conversations between Tony and the Colombian drug trafficking organization were related to that Colombian drug operation's conspiracy to distribute drugs, which included, for that drug trafficking organization, the distribution of drugs into Louisiana.
That would all make sense if the affidavit, and I understand the argument completely. I don't understand why the affiant did not say then, we think that he is part of this operation because he's talking to the same head honcho or delivery guy or whatever his title was.
And I apologize that I don't have the language directly at my fingertips, but they did state that they were investigating, that they believed that further information on this, the geolocation, would give them further information on the crimes that were being committed by those three. And they listed the individuals in New Orleans, the individuals in Colombia, and Tony. And so I think the reasonable inference from this is that they believed the information that they would receive would be information relevant to their investigation of the New Orleans drug trafficking organization. Even if Tony was a separate spoke, they were investigating the hub, the drug trafficking organization in Colombia. So information regarding Tony could be relevant to the New Orleans drug trafficking, as it could have provided evidence in any number of ways that could potentially be admissible, even in a drug trafficking prosecution that didn't have to do with Tony. So I think that's what I'm trying to decouple is Mr. Magruder's argument is that we needed to establish Tony could be responsible for crimes in New Orleans before we can even look at his information. And I don't think that's what's required under the act. I think what's required under the act is that there be jurisdiction over the offense that they are investigating. And when they're investigating a drug conspiracy to import drugs into New Orleans, and they have a wiretap where an individual is discussing receiving and drug proceeds and providing drug proceeds and picking up drugs and dealing with drugs, that provides a sufficient nexus for them to explore that further and to gather that evidence, because that evidence, there's a probable cause that evidence would be relevant even to just the New Orleans trafficking organization.
Well, defense counsel indicates that when you are on the ground right there in D.C. with respect to Mr. Magruder, there's no evidence in the record about what you knew, you know, with respect to him. And it's only at the time that you pull him aside and search his backpack that you then come into anything that is potentially criminal. Can you just respond to that allegation?
So I think I would disagree with that, Judge Childs. Turning to the probable cause argument that he has made, it's very clear that a judge of the District of Columbia who issued a wiretapping warrant determined that there had been previous indication of, or there had been a previous finding that there was probable cause that Tony was involved in distribution, a conspiracy, money laundering, and use of communication facilities to facilitate drug trafficking. Those probable cause determinations had already been made. And as he conceded in response to Judge Millett's question, There's no doubt that there was probable cause for those agents. And as the discussion with Judge Millett continued, there are cases that stand for the fact that where that probable cause exists and where there is a basis for that arrest, we don't look at the subjective intent of those FBI officers as to which particular crime they are necessarily arresting for. I would argue that there is nothing in the record that indicates those officers weren't arresting him for the crime that he committed. I believe there was probable cause to believe that he was transporting drugs at that time. He was engaged in physical travel, which was entirely consistent with the physical travel he had been engaged in previously for the prior crimes that the judge had found probable cause to believe was possession of narcotics and drug conspiracy. So I do believe that there was probable cause for the crime itself that was charged. But we don't look post hoc. We don't look at what ultimately was indicted. We look at the time of the arrest. Was there probable cause for them to arrest him for something? And I think one final point I'd like to make, I see my time is up. Defense counsel noted that the arrest was triggered by the search rather than having been engaged in person. I don't think there's anything in the record that supports that. And because this is a motion to withdraw after there's already been a plea agreement, it is his burden below to show both deficiency and prejudice. So he has the burden to show prejudice, which means he has the burden to show that there was some Fourth Amendment violation. And it's not a reasonable inference that these officers who had engaged in a months-long investigation of this individual would do a takedown and not intend to arrest that individual. I think it just doesn't make sense. And there is nothing in the record that indicates that they had anything but an intention to seize drugs the next time he went to New York. In the warrant where they sought the geolocation itself, and this is on page A148, they specifically said that geolocation service will assist them in effecting a seizure of the drugs because they believed he was going to travel to New York again. And that is exactly what they did. When he went to New York, they arrested him and seized those drugs and charged him with the resulting crime. If there are no further questions, we'd ask to affirm.
Thank you. Again, Judge Childs, I am not denying that agents knew a lot about Mr. Edwards by the time he got off the bus. I'm making an argument about the applicability in this case of the search incident to arrest doctrine and how it is being stretched beyond recognition, beyond prior precedent, to apply to a crime that, notwithstanding counsel's testimony today that there was a takedown going on, there is actually no evidence that when he got off the bus, they were intending to arrest him for a drug conspiracy for which they had evidence from, and they did have evidence of conversations. They had been following him, but there's no evidence that they were intending to do a takedown right then, but they certainly did as
why
described.
Be there? Why be there? I mean, why even be, and I'm referring to the agents at the train station or whatever, if you will,
to do a search
on this particular individual.
To do a search, and that's exactly what they did, and they found something, and then they arrested him. And there's no, and counsel is doing a bit of burden shifting here, when it's actually the government's burden to justify a warrantless search, and there's no evidence in the record supporting a search incident to arrest under any of these cases because of what I've been describing. So I just wanted to clear that up because we have other reasons for disputing that search than the ones that you think that you think I have. Now, I would like to go back to the Louisiana warrant, and you can see from counsel's argument right now how dependent he is on this notion that the person talking to Tony was the source of the drugs for the others, and how dependent he is for that being the way to establish the jurisdiction of the Louisiana court to issue that warrant. And my point laser focuses on that connection, because I'm not saying that the only way to establish jurisdiction in Louisiana over Mr. Magruder's activities would be to have him running around Louisiana. I am saying, however, that what they don't have that, that's for sure. They don't have him running around Louisiana, any connection between him directly in the Louisiana case, but they also can't really establish this link through Columbia except by asking the court to say You know, it's okay to say it is believed that. And counsel keeps referring to him, to this Colombian as the source, as the supplier, but it all comes down to faith that somebody, someone out there, sometime, for some reason, had arrived at the right conclusion that he was the source for the Houston and New Orleans drug conspiracy. And that is way too thin. That is not probable cause, and a trained agent would know that.
Well, he says, I believe, based on training and experience in these conversations, not just that, we're discussing the trafficking of multiple kilograms of cocaine and heroin, and he talked about the sort of language, the code language that was used, and then says that given that he's talking to the same guy about the same drugs that are being moved into Louisiana, that the geolocation information will be evidence of Tony's membership in the drug conspiracy. And the drug conspiracy is one that the Louisiana court had jurisdiction over.
Your Honor, there's nothing but the belief of someone out there that this person was the source. There's a belief and one phone call, perhaps, at least one phone call.
They had multiple phone calls that they thought this person was the source of the drugs that were going to the other people, Cacho and other, there's too many names here for me to keep straight.
No, Your Honor, no, not multiple phone calls, no. And that's my point, is that we don't know when at least one phone call was placed connecting up this chain of people. And if you look mm-hmm. at it closely, there's mm-hmm. just, as I put it in the opening brief, just a gossamer thread established factually between these people. And other than that, belief.
Agent, and you haven't, I had understood you to challenge this. One of the probable cause allegations is that Mascara Esperia was the Colombia-based supplier in coordination with CACHU, Cashew, who was a Louisiana, part of the Louisiana drug conspiracy. Probable cause, obviously this is a probable cause. All right, and you haven't disputed that.
I have disputed that.
I thought your argument was it wasn't probable cause as to Tony. You're saying there's not probable cause as to Mascara Esperia either?
I'm saying that connection through the Colombian, and there are two Mascaras involved here, but
I know, but Esperia is the one that was the supplier.
According to the government and according to someone's belief, Your Honor, that's precisely the point that I'm challenging here, which is that the government wanted the magistrate judge and now wants this court to believe that that person was the supplier in Houston and Louisiana. But if you look at what they offer—
They've already got a separate warrant on Mascara Esperia. I mean, I don't know how you can read this affidavit and say there wasn't probable cause to think that there was a basis for tapping Mascara Esperia's phone as the supplier of drugs into Louisiana through the other individuals, Mascara Amari or Cashew. And then this other guy shows up on the phone and they say, well, we think he might be part of the— he's having the same coded conversations. He's having coded conversations, and so we think he's part of the drug conspiracy.
Your Honor, there are two Mascaras. There's Mascara Amari and Mascara Esperia.
Yes.
And by the way, the government also tries to introduce later search warrants as to the link with Mr. Magruder or Tony. And the court should not be looking, no court should be looking to future later search warrants to establish probable cause for the one that issued. So
I'm very confused as to your argument. Let me understand that your argument is that they didn't even have probable cause to think that Mascara Esperia was the source in Colombia and to have a warrant on his phone?
Not presented in this affidavit, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your
whole argument was about probable cause as to Tony.
Oh, no, I'm glad I cleared that up. Now, what my brief says is that the link between Tony and the search warrant, the investigation in Louisiana, goes through Colombia and goes through this person, Mascara Esperia, who it is asserted in this is the source of what's going on in Louisiana. However, if you examine the facts introduced here, there's completely insignificant support for that proposition repeated again here today over and over. And if you look at that, the affiant put into that proposition that the person talking to Tony was the source for all these drugs going to Louisiana, there's just not a significant amount of information. And this court cannot be permitting search warrants to issue with key elements such as the jurisdictional nexus being established by statements like it is believed that, because that's all they got. And we cannot let agents do that.
It's not all they've got. There's a lot of facts about coded conversation, who's calling who and who's talking to who when.
That's all that brings the jurisdiction together, Your Honor.
Got it.
That's,
I understand your argument.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Serby, you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Magruder. We thank you for your assistance.
Thank you, Your Honor.